Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In 2020, events have again shone a light on inequalities across the globe, and Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
Policy Forum Pod, the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and our region. I'm Professor Sharon Bessel from the Crawford School of Public Policy, and I'm back again with Anna Greta Hunter. Anna Greta, hi.
Hi, Sharon. And for those who don't know me, I'm Anna Greta Hunter. I'm a cardiologist and part of the ANU Medical School, and I'm the Human Futures Fellow here at ANU this year.
And Anna Greta and I are at the moment having a ball with these conversations with incredible people about fundamentally important issues. And this week, we're back with episode 4 of our Wellbeing Economy mini-series as part of Policy Forum Pod, looking at new ideas and approaches to how economics might help reshape society for the better. And we've been looking at things such as basic income that we talked about last week with our fantastic guest, Professor Guy Standing. Policy Forum Pod is produced by Policy Forum Net, right here at the Crawford School of Public Policy, which is the Asia Pacific's leading graduate public policy school. Do have a look at our degree programs and our short courses at crawford.anu.edu.au/study, and have a bit of a delve into some of the amazing programs that we offer. And as we move into 2021, we're going to be offering a really exciting Crawford combined model that puts together both online and face-to-face learning. So do go and have a look at what we've got on offer. On this episode today, we want to discuss global development in light of the coronavirus pandemic. COVID-19 has changed the lives of people around the world, and it's pushed governments to respond with previously unseen welfare interventions. Yet social and economic inequality are deepening around the globe, with a widening gender pay gap, lack of access to stable internet, rising protectionism in a number of countries, and societies are increasingly facing what look like intractable difficulties. A recent report by the OECD shows that developing countries are facing a shortfall of about US $1.7 trillion in the financing that they would need this year to keep them on track for the 2030 Sustainable Development Goals. And of course, as we face this global pandemic, the question arises as to whether the SDGs themselves are still fit for purpose.
It's a really important question. So today, that's what we want to ask. We want to ask how COVID-19 has reshaped countries' development and what can policymakers do to ensure that development is more sustainable and equitable going forward. And so joining us on today's discussion is Professor David Hulme. He is the Professor of Development Studies at the University of Manchester, where he's also the Executive Director of the Global Development Institute and CEO of the Effective State and Inclusive Development Research Centre. He's worked on rural development, poverty and poverty reduction, microfinance, the role of the NGO in conflict and peace and development, environmental management, social protection, and the political economy of global poverty for more than 30 years. His main focus has been on Bangladesh, but he's also worked extensively across South Asia, East Africa, and the Pacific. David, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's very good to join you in this fascinating series.
Yeah, well, we're certainly having a great time in this conversation, and we're very grateful for the time that you can offer our listeners today. You've written a great deal on global development and the politics that underpins development. What, for you, is development? How would you conceptualize or define it?
Yeah, no, that's starting with the simple questions. What is development? I think development, at the sort of the most general level, is human flourishing, and it is for all human beings to be able to aspire and to be able to partially achieve the lives that they value, to be able to have the things, the social relationships, some of the material goods that they want. I mean, I rather like the idea that's come out of Latin America recently of sort of buen vivir, and the idea of people being able to live a good life, and a good life being people being able to achieve the things they want in life, but in ways that don't damage the lives of other people, so that people can achieve some economic goals, but also their health goals, their social goals, think about their relationships, think about how they manage the progress of their life over time, but one in which they are not actually damaging other people by promoting inequality, or by using so much of the world's resources which they are causing a climate change and damaging the prospects of others who use that environment. So I'd see it as fairly broadly based. And I suppose in terms of the question that you've been putting for some of this series, I think we need to look at the economics of development and look at the economics of growth, but we need to move well beyond that, or we'll be focusing upon a means to development. And people, in a way, need to have the income and the resources to be able to flourish in life. But simply accumulating more and more resources for yourself is definitely not going to, I think, lead to personal development or to development across society and more broadly across the entire globe.
Well, I think that's a beautiful way to start. And those key phrases of the human flourishing and what it is to lead a good life. I think that those two ideas are really core to this series that we've been discussing, as you mentioned. But maybe if we're starting this conversation, how would you describe the dominant or orthodox approach to global development?
Well, the orthodox approach, I mean, as with all these things, one is always simplifying on them. But, I mean, conventionally, the idea of development was very much associated with economic growth and with increasing GDP per capita, GNI, gross national income per capita nowadays, and was very closely associated with that growth. But that was with the assumption that then, in a way, somehow all good things came together, and that if you had economic growth, then health and education and somehow democracy would follow alongside that growth. What we've certainly found, I mean, going back into the 1960s and 1970s, was that growth was sometimes hard to achieve, but when it was achieved, it didn't necessarily lead to broader development and to human flourishing. And that was quite often because the growth, in a way, had side effects, such as destroying the environment, stopping other people from being able to make their livelihoods, stopping other people from being able to live the lives which they wanted to pursue. It also led to inequality, which allowed groups of people to dominate other groups, so that one could have economic growth, but alongside it, one had very high levels of poverty. That was challenged. As we moved into the 1990s, there was a full-blooded neoliberal period in the 1980s when simply leaving everything to the market and relying upon prices to allocate all goods and services was believed to be the way to get development, because that would allow everybody to compete, and somehow that intense competition would mean that everybody would get what they deserved, what they were contributing. And in the 1990s, we did begin to move to broader ideas, particularly with Amartya Sen's work and his ideas about human capabilities, but particularly the way that was simplified into the idea of human development. And we began to move into the idea of looking at a human development index, the human development reports, which the United Nations produced. That got some traction and led many people to think about development more broadly. But there still seems, certainly, whether one's looking at democratic or more autocratic political systems, seem to be this belief in economic growth that leaders and those close to leaderships have. And certainly in most political settings, then there seems to be a strong belief that economic growth, as it's conventionally understood, producing sort of goods and services that have market prices attached to them, that is essential. I believe that's essential partly to keep, I suppose, the public and broader society hanging in with one, but also when one begins to look at the politics, then economic growth often seems to meet the needs of those who hold elite and privileged positions in a country and internationally. And so whilst the idea of economic growth as being what development is about has been challenged, it's proving difficult to move away from it. Back in the late 2000s, the Sarkozy Commission, convened by President Sarkozy in France, got a whole set of economists and development specialists, including Nobel Prize winners like Amartya Sen and Joe Stiglitz, and they looked at how they could create some broader measure that national governments and national leaders could use that wouldn't just be about growth, but it would be about health and education and people being able to achieve the goals that they wanted in a sustainable way. That produced an excellent report and was well fed into the media, but still this falling back to growth as the thing that one must always look at when push comes to shove. If times get difficult, then it's growth that leaders seem to look for.
David, that's a fantastic mapping, I think, of the thinking around development, you know, over the past several decades. And I guess we now find ourselves at a moment in time as a result of this really awful pandemic of perhaps having an opportunity to think rather differently. And back in April of this year, you wrote a piece in Global Policy with Rory Horner, where you mapped out possible scenarios, the ugly, the bad, and the good that might result from the global pandemic. And I think one of the lovely things about that piece was there was the optimism of what the good might be. But also one of the things that struck me in that piece was the quote that you used when you said, or you described, the oft-found crisis tendency of socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. I wonder if you could just tease out what you meant by that phrase and whether that's what we are seeing several months on from that piece that you wrote in April.
Yes, no, I think when we were looking at that, we were certainly we're thinking about the COVID-19 crisis, but also looking back to the global financial crisis of 2008, 2009, and were very much, I suppose, influenced by the fact that when you look back to 2008, 2009, and earlier periods of financial crisis, then the banks have to be bailed out, and the very wealthy people who own the banks or have the shares in the banks or have their assets associated, particularly with finance, but also with other forms of corporate activity, they end up being protected by the public purse so that they get the benefits of money being shared out. But that actually, when you look at the costs, who takes the costs on that are caused by crises of various sorts, then often that is very much the poor, and particularly those in the informal sector who tend to get, in a way, purely market-based impacts passing through to their lives. And because they're not actually formally recognized, formally employed, they don't get the benefits of unemployment or of subsidized health services or forms of support to maintain them through the period. So it is that there's certainly been an experience in the past where the protection that states offer to citizens and groups when a crisis occurs, that ends up being concentrated on better off groups and those who hold assets, and is not extended to those who are most desperately in need and who are suffering most deeply. And I think we can certainly see that in many of the responses, well, many of the things that have happened with COVID-19. I mean, when one looks at inequality and that sort of expression, one has to recognize one's position. I'm an upper middle class person in the UK. So the COVID-19 crisis has not been particularly bad for me. My salary continues to come in. I have the National Health Service available for me. The shops in the area where I live have kept running, and I've actually had some benefits. I can take walks at different times of day because I work by Zoom and on the internet. So actually, I've got more control over the things that I can do with the day. I don't have to spend an hour and a half a day driving into Manchester and driving out. When one looks at the other end of the scale, the people I tend to look at most closely are people in Bangladesh, people living in villages, and people living in the informal settlements and slums in Dhaka and Chittagong. And COVID-19 has absolutely stalled their capacity to get livelihoods. Work that we're doing at Manchester, which monitors 60 families in rural Bangladesh, has shown the way that their income fell dramatically when the government tried to lock down in late March and April. And although it's come up very slightly, they're still in a very depressed economy. Very few opportunities to get income. Their opportunities to engage with agriculture greatly reduced, and their access to health services really stopped. And so it is that often the way that states respond to a crisis actually ends up protecting those who have assets and are wealthy, and actually is not able to cope or chooses not to cope so well with the problems that face lower income groups and poorer people. And you've probably got the same issues in Australia, but certainly when one looks at the UK, whilst I can go to the shops and get the things that I want, our food banks are expanding enormously, and the demand for food banks giving poor households access to very basic food through charity has grown enormously over the last six months, and looks like it is really going to increase as we move on into winter. So our governments are doing a lot, are apparently spending a lot on welfare, but still those at the bottom of the income and the livelihoods continuum seem to be not getting the support that one would hope the government would give them.
David, we're seeing very similar things happening here in Australia. And I think the other very powerful thing that I take from the comments that you made about Bangladesh is so much of the coverage that we're seeing in the media, in Australia at least, of COVID-19 and its impacts is focusing on relatively wealthy countries, where there certainly are some devastating impacts on people's lives. But what we're seeing much less of is what's happening in developing countries in the global south. So I think it's so important that we think about that part of the picture as well. But I was thinking, as you were talking about food banks in the UK and the greater urgency of need, about some of the really interesting things that we've seen. And one of the things that we've been looking at from Australia is the role of someone like Marcus Rashford, who has played such an important political role in arguing for the need to feed hungry children, and using his status as a footballer and as a celebrity to be able to put that issue onto the agenda. How important do you think it is for people like Rashford, who are not normal political players, to engage in those debates at the moment?
Well, sort of two different aspects on this. I think what Rashford has done and the way that he's got attention for the issue of how children will get access to food when they're not getting free school meals is incredibly important. I mean, the thing that one would criticize him about is that he's looking for a charitable route to solve the problem. But the thing that one really needs to praise him about is he's forced the government to think about its policies and how they relate to particularly to poor children in poor households. And that is incredibly important. And certainly in the UK, yeah, we certainly have a government which, although it's actually won a lot of seats in the poorer parts of the UK, doesn't seem to have the channels open to be able to talk to the people, to many of the working class people in the poorer households who decided to vote for the government last year. And you actually see this in the Conservative Party at the moment. There is a Northern Research Group of Conservative MPs, and they're in a way becoming the awkward squad because they perceive that the policies that have been operating in the UK are coming out of London and don't relate to the deep economic and social problems which quite large numbers of people face in those parts of the UK which deindustrialized in the 60s, 70s and 80s and have not yet found routes to recover. So I think what Rashford is saying in terms of pointing out the way that the Conservative Party may have won the votes last year, but it hasn't created a mechanism to listen to the voices of the people who decided not to vote for Labour as they would have done in the past, but to trust the Conservative Party, that Rashford has really pointed that out. And certainly it just comes out very clearly at the moment that we do have a relatively small centralised policy-making unit at Downing Street, and it is composed of people who come from middle-class and elite backgrounds who don't understand what it's like for the, in a way, hundreds of thousands of millions of families in the Midlands and in the north of the UK who live in areas where the economy has not yet recovered from the collapse of British industry and the quite different types of things that they need. And the fact that, yeah, access to a pound's worth of food at lunchtime for a child could make an enormous difference to that child's, in a way, development in terms of their health, in terms of their ability to concentrate and learn during the day, and in terms of their aspirations and the way that they see themselves flourishing or not flourishing. So I think at the sort of setting new norms and promoting the idea that we need to be thinking much more about what's happening to the disadvantaged households, Marcus Rashford has been very successful.
David, you said that if there was anything that we would perhaps criticise Rashford's approach for, it's the fact that it's kind of based in charity or sees charitable solutions as the way forward. How would you reframe that conversation to move away from the emphasis on charitable giving to something else?
Well, often when one's looking at trying to change policies, then one might look at the role of individuals, but really one needs to be looking at coalitions, at different individuals and groups who are interacting to promote a particular policy change idea. So, if one was to step back and take that sort of academic approach, then one would be arguing that Rashford should just push a little bit more that the government needs to move beyond simply saying, oh, we'll give them meals during the holidays, to looking at those households much more comprehensively and how those households will be supported whilst the crisis is still with us, but also how those households will be supported so that as the crisis becomes less significant and we move out of it, that those households will actually get a leg up, that they won't simply be left where they were in the past, that they will actually have access to decent food and be in a better position in terms of planning what they want to achieve and being able to achieve that for the parents, but particularly the parents supporting the children in their aspirations. And in a way, that is being done more broadly by the debates within the Conservative Party, by the way in which the Labour Party has at times supported Conservative policy, but at other times is pushing it so that it actually thinks somewhat more compassionately about those who have very few choices and for whom the COVID-19 crisis has really reduced their options. So I think, one would want to Rashford in a way to keep with his high profile and to keep that agenda getting public attention and getting it in the social media, getting it in the popular media in the UK, whilst others come around to make sure that whilst charity does its best, we get changes in government policy that will mean that we won't get this callousness. And it was remarkable in the UK the way that a few months ago when the continuing school meals during the summer holidays was stopped for children and Rashford came forward and the government decided to continue with it, but then exactly the same in a way withdrawal of the free school meals occurred when we came to the autumn holidays. And I suppose if one was to be rather crude about this, it would be this is certainly some Conservative governments going back to their conventional, their orthodox thinking about poverty and believing that poor people are poor because they don't work hard enough and they don't think hard enough about how to improve their economic position. And the tendency certainly for many Conservatives not to recognise the structural roots of poverty.
David, I think taking that conversation and your definition of development as human flourishing, we see that those critical issues of development apply globally, to what we would generally describe as wealthy countries as well as the global south. And in thinking about some of those issues and ways forward, I wanted to go back again to that global policy piece that you wrote. And you described there a bad scenario as returning to what might be described as the pre-COVID business as usual. And you wrote that's where we have historically high, in inverted commas, levels of human development and relatively low, in inverted commas, levels of absolute poverty. Why do you see that situation as bad and something to be avoided? And perhaps there's a lost opportunity.
It is essentially because if we go back to business as usual and are satisfied with that, then we continue to deepen the problems in a way which were undermining the achievement of a full-blooded global development and of development across the world. And that is if we continue with forms of economic processes which are increasing economic and social inequality, then we will not be moving towards a world in which there is social justice and in which all people can flourish. We'll be allowing some to have exceptionally broad choices with flourishing, but large proportions of humanity to have very few opportunities to flourish. And many of those people still, when they hit a problem like a health problem or something like that, having to move into debt or having to actually, in a way, take on disability or experience an unnecessary premature debt because they cannot get access to very limited quantities of income of resource to get access to health services. So, you know, the bad scenario is going back to allowing inequality to grow. In the way that it was. Extreme poverty, I mean, has been going down, and that's one of the great things we have to celebrate about the late 20th and the early 21st century. But the way in which inequality, and particularly inequality within countries, has been rising has really reduced the ability of economic growth and those growth processes to actually improve lives across the board, and has tended to concentrate benefits in the hands of a limited part of the population. And the second point is obviously about sustainability. And if we go back to the sort of carbon profligate economic growth processes and consumption sort of norms that we that the world had, and that we're extending into Asia and across Africa as a middle class is being created in Africa, then to go back to where we were would be both to fail on the social justice front, but also to fail on the sustainability front. And that seems a pretty bad scenario to me.
Absolutely. David, I think you're joining the chorus in the conversation that we've been having so far, that the opportunity for radical transformation is part of the challenge of 2020, and that the opportunity to approach things quite differently is in front of us. You've spoken about joined up policies for international development. What do you mean by that? And how's it different from the dominant orthodox approaches?
Okay, yeah, no, I mean, the work that we've been doing at the University of Manchester on that has looked at the way that the old idea of international development from the 20th century, which was of rich nations transferring finance or transferring technologies or transferring forms of organization to developing countries, to Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Pacific, that is just totally inappropriate nowadays. And all of our economies and societies are deeply interlinked through trades in goods and services, through the transfer of information. And so in this global development era in which we live, we need to be looking at a set of policies which are not simply about sort of transfers of small amounts of finance or technologies, but really look at trade policies and how trade policies can be reformed so that they will allow lower income countries and lower middle income countries to retain more of the value of the products that they are producing and of the labor that the citizens are creating, to look at finance policies which provide the finance that will allow for economic development, infrastructural development, and development of human services, of health and education in countries, in lower income countries, and that will not lead to indebtedness, and which finance can be in a way well allocated and well targeted, and to look at the way in which the environment now has to be factored into all policies, and we have to look at the way that the advanced nations of the world are producing much more global greenhouse gases, and they have done that historically, and that we take responsibility for that, and that we move very quickly to mitigating those emissions and to financing adaptation in countries in a way that are experiencing the bad effects of those emissions. So it's looking at a much broader range of international linkages and thinking about how we get those so that human flourishing can occur in our own countries, but can also occur in other parts of the world, and for the populations in other parts of the world. Some of that, I mean, does move on to, I think, some of the idea that you're looking at a week or two ago on neoliberalism, and it is somehow how certainly in the West we stop transmitting the idea that greed is good or that incredible wealth is a good thing, and that we get people who aspire to do well economically and aspire to do well socially, but who don't see simply having more and more assets and more resources as a good way for them to proceed.
Absolutely. And so that this reframing of our economic system that allows us to genuinely and deeply account for societal and human well-being and for environmental sustainability, I think, is at the core of our conversation. And that this might be a good place for us to take a very short break, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
And welcome back. We're still here with David Hume. David, it's a fantastic discussion so far. Thank you again for joining us. I might start by asking you about the Sustainable Development Goals and where you see them, their role in bringing about sustainable and equitable development. Are they a game changer, or are they essentially continuing the status quo?
Okay, no, that's a great question. I think the SDGs are an opportunity that those who are looking for transformation must try to use and must use as much as they can do. But they're not a game changer in some foundational sense. And I looked at the Millennium Development Goals that were agreed in 2000-2001, and I did contrast them with the Sustainable Development Goals that were approved in September 2015 at the United Nations General Assembly, but they were sort of developed over 2012-13-14 through a whole set of complicated international conversations. And when you look at the MDGs and the SDGs, then you have got some really big changes in terms of the content, but also in terms of the process. And in terms of the content, probably the really important thing to notice is that inequality comes through as SDG number 10. And inequality was, when one goes back to 2000, was only allowed into the conversation of what all member countries of the UN could agree in 2000. It was only allowed on the edge, and only in terms of reducing gender inequality at the national level. When you get to 2015, then it's possible for the UN membership to agree a goal of reducing inequality within countries and across countries. So it's actually talking about inequality in a broad-based sense should be something that is to be achieved within countries, but also that in a way that wealthier countries should not be as out of kilter as contrasted with poorer countries, that there needs to be a leveling up of the low-income and middle-income countries. So that's potentially a fairly radical change in content. But one does have to say, in a way, these are words on paper and policy statements that are made. And sort of 5 years into the SDGs, there's relatively little evidence that national policies or international policies are changing because of SDG 10. So in a way, it's a move forward, but You know, we have to get the rhetoric to move, but then you have to get the rhetoric to get traction so that policies begin to change. And there's relatively little evidence of that now. And the impact certainly of the COVID-19 crisis will be pretty complicated as one tries to work out how they've knocked onto Sustainable Development Goal number 10. So, you know, I think the SDGs are progress. The way in which I think they haven't managed to really, transform things is in terms of what happens. And certainly in most countries, I still see conventional forms of economic growth, which we talked about earlier on, and in a way, growth by transferring high levels of material consumption to Asia and to Africa as the main form the main route to achieving national development. And that clearly is unsustainable. Those of us who live in high income and high consumption countries have got to reduce our consumption and certainly decarbonize extremely rapidly. And people who are beginning to experience better economic prospects in Asia and Africa and other parts of the world need to be, in a way, taking advantage of those in ways which are not going to produce large volumes of greenhouse gases. So we need those several goals that talk about sustainability. We need to find ways of taking those forward. The sustainability goals do seem to be making progress. That's probably maybe more because of the Paris sort of climate change agreement than the Sustainable Development Goals. But the Sustainable Development Goals, I mean, have great value in that in any formal conversation between nations or even within a nation, you can present those as something which 193 member states of the United Nations have agreed. So what is stated in the Sustainable Development Goals now has greater legitimacy in a way that it mightn't have had it in the past. If I can just two more thoughts occur as I'm talking, if I can go into those. I mean, the interesting thing with the SDG 10 is it does make it much more difficult for people to say inequality is a good thing. And if you look back to the 1980s in the USA and in the UK under Thatcher, then there was a strong belief, which some people were prepared to talk about in public, which is that inequality is a good thing. If I am somehow creating wealth and my bank account is moving from hundreds of millions to billions, then that's good for everybody else because I'm creating jobs and I'm creating opportunities. But as we've seen and as we continue to see, whenever we look closely at those economic processes, quite often that is by people using the labor of others to produce value, but then not allowing those people to benefit from their labor and from the innovations, whether it's physical labor or whether it's creative labor. And so we've seen that those processes continue, but people no longer actually promote inequality as a good thing. And you know, the argument used to run, inequality is good because it leads to differences, which increases competition, and competition is always good, and we need more inequality to keep on driving it. Those sorts of pro-inequality arguments, people tend to back away from them. And if you watch Davos each year, then each year when the world's wealthiest people get together, they all nod their heads that they've got to reduce inequality. But then somehow we can't get them to leave Davos and promote equality the day after.
David, in this series, we've been looking at a whole range of new ideas and approaches, but one of the ideas that has been central to the conversations that we've been having is the idea of a well-being economy. And that's generally discussed as a potential solution to a whole raft of problems, including problems around inequality, around poverty within wealthy countries. Do you think the ideas that underpin a well-being economy have relevance for countries of the global south and indeed for global development?
I must be honest, and I've only looked briefly at the idea of the well-being economy, but it certainly is very appealing. And certainly in Europe, it's similar probably to some of the ideas about a solidarity economy that have been developed, in which one is thinking, people are encouraged to think about their own, in a way, development and economic development processes, but think about the way in which they can also contribute to the well-being of others and or compromise or reduce the well-being of others. The way in which I think a well-being economy may have real value and give insights that are needed, which I can only partly understand, is if one looks at the future of employment, because there's certainly a lot of work pointing out that with artificial intelligence and machine learning, that it's not simply, in a way, those involved in manufacturing labor who may find that their work is being taken over and they're displaced, but it's people actually in jobs as solicitors and general practitioners in medicine who could find that the work is being threatened. But I think if one moves to the idea of a well-being economy, then one could certainly think of employment, which is much more based in people providing personal services to each other, which they value and which allow them to have a reasonably high standard of living in economic terms, but also allow them to enjoy their lives and to feel well, to feel they are living in a good society. And if you've looked at the work of Danny Roderick, he's very pessimistic about global employment prospects because he perceives that manufacturing, in a way, employment around the world has narrowed down with the mechanization and robotic processes which we can now use, and also that in a way that most manufacturing, in a way, for a period, is going to be based in China. So that particularly if one looks at Africa, that Africa hasn't got the opportunity to move on to manufacturing and industrialization as a way of improving incomes and improving human development. But I do think the idea of a well-being economy, if one was actually thinking of more people being involved in counseling, and quite clearly, our mental health needs are much greater around the world, but particularly in high-income countries, than we'd ever allowed. Whereas mental health problems were in a way treated as a small set of problems for a small group of people. We now realise that throughout their lives, many people could certainly do with counselling services and therapy services that will help them think about how they deal with the breakup of social relationships, the ageing process, and a whole set of other issues. Similarly, with physiotherapy and it's Pilates, someone moves on to yoga, but quite clearly there are a whole set of reasonably sort of employment intensive activities which, once people are encouraged to engage in them, can make people feel much better, can actually help them maintain a weight which is more likely to give them long-term health and allow them a whole set of choices about what they do, help them to reduce the likelihood of diabetes and the way in which that constrains lives, and a whole set of physical benefits. So, I find the idea of a well-being economy appealing, and particularly the idea that actually providing services to each other that help us feel good and make us feel good the next day and look forward to the future could be a major part of that economy, in a way which many economists, I think, who have problems in trying to work out how services like physiotherapy on a large scale, like yoga teaching on a large scale, like therapy on a large scale, the way in which they could actually become a more significant component that might make lives more satisfying.
David, you're going to some of the themes that are really coming out strongly through our series. By the by, on the mental health and productivity, we had a Productivity Commission report that was released today that shows a tremendous economic imprint of the mental health challenges that are faced in Australia. It's about 10% of our economic activity is then attributed to, or that is then a cost that's born from a mental health effect. So it's a really profound one. But the two themes that you've just picked up on include thinking about work and what role it plays and how we might be able to reframe work. And the starting point for Sharon and I on this journey was about the value of caring, and the role that caring and the human relationships can play in our economic structure. And so we've seen several initiatives around the world that have sought to go against the business as usual model of economic growth and the neoliberal model, and particularly places, I guess, like Bhutan's idea of gross national happiness and the genuine progress indicator might be a couple of examples. Are these approaches taking us towards a genuine change and towards something like the well-being economy? Do you think they're useful models?
I think they may be, and certainly the recognition that the gradual recognition that caring is not something which is done by women for free, and it's their role to do it, and they should just do it and keep quiet and be happy. But the fact that caring is a central part of our economy, and it needs to be valued, valued in social terms, but also valued in economic terms. I think are beginning to make progress on that. But I suppose the transformation may require a whole set of changes. I was thinking we were using the term mental health, I think, on both sides of the conversation, but whether one can move that towards mental well-being. So it's not seeing therapy and counseling as solutions to a problem that you have, but it's seeing sort of therapy and counseling as a standard thing, which most people need at some stage in their lives, just to help them to balance things out and to keep cheerful and to go on without having that sort of personal angst and anxiety, which can so often, in a way, damage people's experience of day-to-day life and damage them thinking about what they want to do and thinking about their aspirations. So I think definitely valuing the caring economy and thinking about the sorts of ideas that would take that forward. I think one of the big tests in the UK, maybe the same in Australia, when one gets 3 or 4 years beyond COVID-19, assuming that we can get beyond it, we'll be looking at the wages of people who work in the care sector, and seeing whether, as in the UK, they are pitched at the minimum wage and often managed in ways in which people who work in the care sector don't get paid when they're driving between jobs, or have penalties if they're late for appointments, so actually they're paid below minimum wage, to whether one moves to a position in which people who are care workers are valued more in economic terms, and the enormous contribution that they make to society is recognised. At the moment in the UK, as in many other parts of the world, but we've been applauding both our health workers and our care workers. And in May and June this year, then every Thursday night across the UK, people came out of their houses and clapped to say thank you to the National Health, but also to the care workers who are taking care of people who have problems with ageing, problems with disability. A real test will be whether that was being grateful when we were in a crisis moment, but then forgetting those people when things are returning to, inverted commas, normal, or whether we do actually begin to think, the pay rates of these people, the way in which they're treated in society, is just not fair, given the amazing contribution that they make. That will definitely be one of the tests that I'll be thinking about, looking at whether care workers' wage rates and conditions are improving, or whether they've slipped back. And if they do slip back, it would suggest that the idea of a well-being economy is not advancing at the speed that you and I might like it to.
I think that's a fantastic indicator, David, in terms of how we take this moment as an opportunity for change, or whether we do just slip back into, the bad or the ugly, where we don't appreciate and value and respond accordingly to the people who play such a critical role within our societies. And I guess the other thing that will be an indicator as we move beyond COVID or learn to live with COVID is how we think about and how we address poverty, which is becoming an increasing problem. We're seeing the backsliding in both wealthy countries but also across the global south as a direct result of the pandemic. And one of the arguments that you've put forward prior to the context of COVID is that to address poverty, we should give money to the poor. And that's an argument that's been described as an elegantly simple solution. Are you arguing here for something like universal basic income, or do you see another model in terms of simply giving money to the poor as a means of addressing poverty?
That's a great question, and we do have to recognise, I think, the World Bank looking at extreme poverty, $1.90 a day poverty, which is, you know, that's an incredibly low measure. That is such an awful life to lead if that's the command of resources that you have in terms of trying to feed yourself, keep warm or keep cool, and pay for some basic health services if needed. But that's gone up by 40 to 80, 90 million. I mean, less positive perspectives say that, you know, we'll be moving into 100 to 200 million more people in extreme poverty. And that's after 25, 30 years of extreme poverty coming down. Then certainly the COVID-19 short-term impact has been to cascade large numbers of people who were above a very basic poverty line below that that line. Just give money to the poor. In a way, when we wrote that book and we'd been looking at social protection, we focused very much upon the national level, and were particularly arguing that in low-income and lower middle-income countries, there were sufficient resources for social protection programs to protect people from unemployment, to ensure that poor households could get a minimum income that would at least allow them to feed their children and clothe their children and allow for their physical advancement. So, I mean, just give money to the poor. We focused very much on the national level. But that was, I think, with a belief that if one begins to get most countries in the world recognizing that relatively small sums of cash transfers, if it's well done and well managed, would greatly reduce extreme poverty, and then we could move on to thinking perhaps about a universal basic income, and or thinking about how we begin to look at relative poverty and how we tackle relative poverty. The universal basic income, I think you've had Guy Standing, so you've heard the strong case that can be made for that. At the moment, I think if one was looking at it, the problem is the global solidarity that one would need if one was moving to universal basic income, because that would require some systematic form of, in a way, international taxation or committed long-term international finance, which certainly at the moment is lacking in the world. One is not going to get that in the United Nations at the moment. Even though we may be optimistic about some of the changes in the States, it's unimaginable that a US president would actually take a lead in putting an idea like that. China, although it is trying to understand its position in a way in leading on issues of global development, is not likely to take on such an ambitious idea. So I think promoting the idea of universal basic income remains a significant and important activity, because it confronts the sort of norms that allocate resources at the moment, that shape growth processes, and we need to keep on confronting them. But I would still be looking, in a way, focusing at the national level on trying to get social protection systems established, particularly in low-income countries and lower middle-income countries, which give the poorest people a way out of their deep poverty, but then moving on to thinking about, so if we use a relative idea of poverty, how would we improve those who are relatively poor and reduce inequality at the same time? I mean, interestingly, I think if one looks at China at the moment, they are beginning to move in that sort of direction in rhetoric, if maybe not yet in policy. But certainly China is perceiving itself as having almost overcome the problem of extreme poverty, but has begun to talk in the last 2 or 3 years much more about how is inequality reduced, and is realizing that in a way we need policies that hand in hand reduce extreme poverty, but also don't accept that's where social protection stops, and that then look at, well, how do we move on to those who may be above some incredibly basic level? How do we move on to integrating them more fully into society so that we don't have these very high and unacceptable levels of inequality?
That's a wonderful description, I think, of where we're at. David, you've very eloquently walked us through a complicated landscape around global human development and the relationship with the current economic paradigm of the world in which we live. I think you've offered us some of the inclusive and integrated approaches that we could see in terms of solutions that might help us with seeing human flourishing, and perhaps giving us some clues about how to frame policies that approach a good life. To finish today's conversation, I wonder if you might give us your favourite suggestion for how we might begin to achieve these big changes.
I give you two. I'll be greedy on it. I think one of the things we're involved in is this war of ideas, and we have to keep pushing forward sort of ideas and values that really challenge and confront. And so I think, you know, in terms of ideas, it is particularly pushing forward the idea that reducing inequality within one's locality, within one state, and within one's nation is an idea that needs to keep on being chipped away at. And at the same time, recognizing that not as detracting from everybody's life, but that is giving us, in a way, the good life, the buen vivir, as they say in Latin America, the life that we can live in one world. And recognizing that certainly so much work on OECD countries, in the book by Wilkinson and Pickett on the spirit level, showed the way that actually, as societies become more equal, then actually the wealthy are happier with that, as well as the middle income and the lower incomes, that equality actually gives everybody the sort of world in which they'd like to live. So I think we need to keep battling on that world of ideas in practical terms. And I think you've looked at this then. Everybody should be looking at their personal carbon footprint and working out how they can reduce that, because we've got to reduce global greenhouse gas emissions quickly. So certainly for those of us who are carbon profligate, which is most middle-class people in high-income countries, then we do have to look at which sources we're getting our electricity from, what sort of vehicle we drive, whether we need to drive it, whether we can greatly reduce our meat consumption, and a set of personal choices like that. So I think we need to think grand in terms of ideas and how we promote the ideas, and micro in terms of the way in which we actually change our lives so that our carbon footprint is smaller.
What a way to finish, David. It's been such a fantastically inspirational discussion. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. That's been a really a fascinating conversation, and great to be able to have these conversations with colleagues in Australia without having to fly to Australia.
Absolutely. Some of the advantages, I suppose, of the coronavirus pandemic. But it's fantastic to have you join us. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, David.
Okay, thank you.
So, Anna-Greta, yet another amazing conversation in this series. But I'm starting to feel like pieces are fitting together here. We're seeing some really powerful and consistent themes emerging around rethinking work, around the importance of both the local and the global. You know, David summed that up beautifully when he talked about pursuing the big ideas while making the changes at the local level. What did you take away from that conversation?
What an inspiring man, and an extraordinarily inspirational framing of the challenge that we face in terms of economic change and the opportunities for really significant societal benefit to rethinking ideas around consumptogenic growth. And, for me, he described the benefits of that really quite profoundly. It is extraordinary to see how the threads are coming together. We've spoken to economists, we've spoken to political scientists, we've spoken to climate scientists, we've spoken to people who are expert in universal basic income, and tonight we've been speaking to someone whose expertise is in development. And it is remarkable across the different silos and the different perspectives how these themes are emerging to rethink, to challenge the norms, to really look at the opportunities for radical transformation. A deeply inspiring discussion tonight.
Yes, it really was. There was so much to take away from that. And the thing that I'm taking from these conversations is that initial feeling that this is all overwhelming, that these challenges are just enormous. How can we even begin to think about the first step? But then as we talk to people like David Hume, you start to see where the solutions can come. Mm. And so I feel myself shifting from that sense of being overwhelmed to that incredible sense of optimism.
Absolutely.
That we can make change. There are solutions that are there waiting for us to grasp. And I guess we do have a moment in time now with this extraordinary global situation that we find ourselves in. And we get a vision of what David called the ugly or the bad, but we also get a vision of the good and perhaps even better than that, that we can create. Mm. So I think it's that sense of a way forward and a sense of optimism that is leaving me feeling so inspired by these conversations.
Mm. Absolutely. Yep. Inspiring in terms of our imagination. And you feel the window flapping this year in 2020, that policy window flaps open from time to time. There's a tremendous appetite, I think, for us to do things better in the future and really to address these complex and really wicked problems.
Yep. So we need to climb through that window together.
We do. We do. And I think we've got a little team of people to work with, which is always the best way to do that. Sharon, what have we got coming up on the next episode?
Well, we have covered, as you've said, so many issues from politics to climate change to international development. But Anna-Greta, health. We have you sitting here, the Canberra health doctor, the Canberra heart doctor, I should say. Health is so central to all of these things that we're talking about, and health broadly defined. So what do you say? Is it time to talk health?
Absolutely. It's always the time to talk health, but it's the raison d'être that drives a lot of these policy decisions. I'm not the right expert for that. We need to speak to Sharon Friel. That's the person we really need to have on. Do you think she'll come and speak to us next week?
I think if we tempt her in this direction with some exciting conversation, maybe a glass of whiskey, we could entice Sharon in this direction.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
I say we ask.
So let's have I think there's a good chance that we'll have Sharon Friel join us on the next episode of our wellbeing exploration for Policy Forum Pod. And between now and then, we would both love you to join the conversation that we've been having together and with our visitors so far. And that you can do that by reaching out to us on Twitter at APS Policy Forum or APS Policy Forum. Or you can email us at podcast@policyforum.net. Or both Sharon and I are active on Twitter. You can find our podcast, of course, through the usual sites on Acast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to it. And if you have a chance to leave a review, then that would be greatly appreciated. And we'd love to see you join our Facebook group, where there's always a really interesting set of conversations around the recent topics of discussion. And you can join an interested and engaged group of commentators. So next week we'll be back with another episode in the Wellbeing Economy, and we're looking forward to having Sharon Friel join us. But we're really also looking forward to continuing this global discussion at a local level, and we hope that some of the ideas that we've created so far might foster some fantastic discussion.
Thanks, Anna-Greta. Looking forward to next week and looking forward to continuing these conversations with our listeners. So until next week, bye-bye from me.
See you next week, Sharon. Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.